Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare administration and policy at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, it's our monthly medical roundtable. Then our experts answer your questions. But first, here are a few topics we're covering today from the latest health headlines. Abortion pills, social media, do-it-yourself medicine, Alzheimer's, coffee, flying, and yes, the four tops. We've got it all here. Joining us to talk about these are our A-team of doctors. First is Dr. Jennifer Cowart. She is a hospitalist in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Cowart, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be here.
It's so good to have you back. We have Dr. Joseph Drazkowski. He is a professor of neurology. He is at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, where he's a practicing neurologist there in Phoenix. Dr. Drazkowski, welcome back.
Hey, thank you very much. Always fun to be here.
It's great to have you here. And last but not least, another veteran of our program, Dr. Dacre Knight. He's an internist. He also heads the Ehlers-Danlos Clinic at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Knight, welcome back as well.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here.
So we're going to get started with where headlines have dominated, and that have been in women's health issues. Dr. Cowart, I'm going to start with you. As you well know, the Supreme Court upheld access to mifepristone, an abortion pill approved by the FDA, rejecting a challenge from anti-abortion groups. Justice Brett Kavanaugh commented on the unanimous decision, stating that the plaintiffs lack standing but could seek regulatory or legislative restrictions. The case focused on FDA changes in 2016 and 2021 that eased access via telemedicine and mail. Now, while abortion rights supporters were relieved, they warned that their legal attacks will continue. The court's going to address another abortion-related case. The challenge originating in Texas questions mifepristone's safety despite substantial scientific evidence supporting its safety. So, Dr. Cowart, just to remind us all, what is mifepristone?
Thanks, Joe. So, you know, talking about this very charged subject, I'll try to keep it just pretty factual as much as I can. So mifepristone is a tablet that is used for medication abortion. It's used usually in conjunction with a second medication called misoprostol. So the combination of mifepristone and misoprostol is the most common method for inducing abortion in the United States. Mifepristone was first approved in 2000 by the FDA, and subsequently a generic was approved, and there were other regulatory regulations that were relaxed in those years by the FDA that were challenged in this court case. So it is effective and prescribed when a pregnant person is seeking an abortion up to 10 weeks when a an ectopic pregnancy or pregnancy outside the uterus is not suspected. So that, you know, not for use for ectopic pregnancies. When used as intended, it is safe and effective. In the vast majority of cases, if there are complications, as there can be with any medication we use, including things like Tylenol and aspirin, if there are complications, and that's why there are providers who have prescribed this drug who would be available to monitor that. So this decision in upholding the FDA's normal course of business, and they approve this drug based off of the usual studies that they approve all of the medications that we are able to prescribe as physicians in the United States, upholding that they're being able to use their normal process is very important, because the FDA is directed by law to approve medications according to the usual standards with scientific studies. So it would be highly irregular to go back 24 years and retroactively say they violated their constitutional standing. And that was where this decision came down. It was a very narrow decision. It said that the plaintiffs lacked standing. No one was forcing these doctors who were suing to provide any kind of abortion services. Patients may seek out abortion, and providers may decide whether or not they wish to provide for abortions. But as you noted, Justice Kavanaugh did comment that this, while the plaintiffs lack standing, there are other paths available for people who wish to erode away at the ability for people to seek abortions. And so this was not the final discussion on mifepristone. There are other proposed restrictions. And so I do think, for folks like myself personally, who believe that it's important for women to have access to safe and legal ability to terminate a pregnancy, having access to medication abortion is very important and key for women's health. And so this is something that I'm happy to have seen personally, but with that caution that this is not the end of the discussion.
One last question, Dr. Coward, on this topic. This is also a big test on the FDA. How important is this decision for the FDA and how it runs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the FDA has longstanding processes, and there are critiques of that process. Certainly, some folks would say they run too slow in some and too fast in others. We've talked about different drugs on this show that we felt like were, you know, somewhat fast-tracked. But they are a regulatory agency that is given this directive by Congress. They are directly given this authority to be able to approve drugs. So attacking their ability to have approved a drug using their own processes really would make it much harder for the FDA to be able to approve new drugs using their same processes. Whether or not we personally agree with the drug being used, the FDA uses the same scientific standards to be able to approve them. So I think it would be a real challenge to the FDA's regulatory authority if every decision that they made was then questioned politically and challenged in court.
Let's go to on the same topic of the FDA, but a different medical issue. Dr. Druskowski, yet another Alzheimer's drug looks like it's about to get FDA approval. The FDA Advisory Committee endorsed Eli Lilly's, and I want to make a disclosure here that is a supporter of the show, Alzheimer's drug donanemab, which showed a 35% reduction in cognitive decline over 18 months in early stage patients. Safety concerns arose due to 3 fatalities from ARIA. This is bleeding of the brain or swelling. Now, despite these risks, the FDA is optimistic about its potential approval, offering yet another hope for Alzheimer's patients. Dr. Druskowski, what, to the best of your knowledge, can you tell us just a little bit about donanemab?
Donanemab is a monoclonal antibody. Just as background, Alzheimer's disease is a neurodegenerative process that builds up certain proteins within the brain that causes dysfunction over time. And the drug itself is designed to bind to these proteins and destroy them. And as such, they want to reduce the issues related to the disease as it progresses. So that's why they say it's a reduction in the decline of function over time. And I think that's an important distinction on this type of drug. It's not necessarily a cure, but it does help indeed offer hope in reducing the effects of the disease over time. So in that way, it's kind of a disease-related, disease-specific medication that is, important. It helps most in the early stages, of often called mild cognitive impairment, and it's been pretty well studied.
Do you think it brings value, or what value do you think it may bring to this?
What I've noticed with this class of medications, and I'm not an Alzheimer's specialist, but I, you know, as the population ages, all of our patients have issues like this, and it comes up frequently. The value is an extremely complex topic, and it includes all kinds of costs and caring for the patient and programs for the patient. You mentioned ARIA; it's one of the side effects of the medication that necessitates a outpatient program, if you will, to watch for this. So it adds costs of MRI scanning and frequent follow-ups, and there's a whole prescription of care for the patient in addition to the cost of the drug itself, which are notoriously high. We've talked about this on the show before. The cost of the drugs are somewhat staggering at times. But when you look at that, there's some studies, and the experts would say that the cost of the drug over its lifetime is kind of approaching a good value for the reduction in disease process, if you will. As a reminder, in 2021 we spent $355 billion on this. Wow. On this disorder, and it's expected as we all age, as the baby boomers, and there's going to double, triple, maybe even quadruple that cost. So the cost effectiveness, according to an article in JAMA in 2022, is expected to be about, if you can get the drug at about $20,000 per year. I know that sounds like a lot, but according to their calculations and statistics, it does add a bit of better value. The cost on this one is projected to be around $26,000 per year. So we're close. Wow. And so there may be hope.
Last question, Dr. Drazkowski, is it a game changer?
Well, I think that's more a philosophical question. And I think when we were young, when you and I were young, we had nothing for Alzheimer's. We had some disease treating things. You could treat some symptoms, but that was it. This is a disease modifying agent. And I think when you have that, in my mind, it kind of classifies, the whole group of them classifies as a game changer. And over time, we'll learn about them. Over time, these things will improve, and we'll get new drugs that are in the pipeline as well.
Dr. Knight, I'm going to go to yet another topic. The Washington Post had a nice article about the rise of do-it-yourself medicine or healthcare. And they talked about a story, desperate after her baby Annika's severe food reactions were dismissed by doctors. Angelica Sharma turned to Tiny Health, a startup that offered gut microbiome tests that you do at home. It diagnosed an overgrowth of this P. vulgatus. The company recommended probiotics, sauerkraut, and petting zoo visits. The condition improved rapidly. And it highlights, the reason they brought that up, the rise of at-home health testing driven by distrust in conventional medicine, but creating a parallel of medical ecosystem. And a lot of startup companies are offering these tests for varying conditions. Now, these do-it-yourself approaches can empower patients, but, as usual, there are risks of misdiagnosis, questionable remedies, and regulators aren't keeping up to the level that they may be able to, because scientific validation often lags consumer demand. So I know you manage chronic conditions, Dr. Knight, but have you seen patients using do-it-yourself testing or apps?
Well, yeah, and it is growing, I should definitely say. And the article you mentioned in the Washington Post, I think it gives a very good review of the kind of the whole situation on home health tests and the business they're in. And it's remarkable. I mean, I think they listed around $5 billion industry that, is only increasing. So, we certainly do see these patients come in with testing reports. They want help with assessment and and treatment guidance from these tests. And I might even go out on a limb here and say that there's probably a lot more patients that actually do this test and that don't go into the doctor, just for the reason you mentioned, that there's some distrust with modern healthcare, so they want to take the matter into their own hands. So those that we see may just be a smaller portion, because they have maybe enough trust to go see the doctor, but maybe not quite enough, or maybe they still want to take some control over it. So I think as physicians, we have to recognize that this is a growing practice among our patients to do these home health tests. And I think it sort of ballooned during the pandemic, because, you know, testing COVID positive was, you know, was kind of in our lexicon all of a sudden, that how do you get the test? Who can do it? Do you have access to it? Can you do it at home? Sure. And so some companies capitalized on this and realized that there's a market out there for other conditions. So and I think, you know, the message for patients to know is that some of these tests, while, you know, validated in some respects, still do not have not undergone all the rigorous testing that is required of more validated tests. So be wary of what's out there, and know that in some cases you may be prey to just a good marketing advertising ploy. So definitely have that discussion with your provider about what would be the, you know, most accurate type of test to use and such.
Dr. Nye, one last question on this. Do any apps deserve any special mention of things that impressed you, that, wow, this is really incredible, versus this concerns me?
Well, there are so many out there, and it's almost seems like every day or every time a patient comes in is a new one that I haven't heard of. So they're growing fast, almost faster than we can keep up with, which is troubling, because we want to be knowledgeable and be able to and provide insight to patients. The ones that I'd say stand out are probably the ones that are not, you know, I guess, the least snake oil type, that, you know, not promising to, you know, be life-changing and such, but probably those that are helping monitor health trackers, just kind of general health. So whether that's monitoring your steps or your sleep and activity levels and things like that. So there's any number of those. I myself use Strava, actually, is a good one. So when I'm out exercising, it kind of keeps track of how long you're exercising, and you can see a portfolio of what you've done through the week. And but there are many others. I know Fitbit got, you know, a head start into this, health tracking. And so there are definitely some good ones out there, but there are so many to choose from.
Fair enough. I'm going to now move to yet another topic. So the U.S. Surgeon General made headlines this week, and I'm going to quote him directly. Dr. Vivek Murthy said, "Why is it that we've failed to respond to the harms of social media when they are no less urgent or widespread than those posed by unsafe cars, planes, or food? These harms are not a failure of willpower and parenting. They are the consequence of unleashing powerful technology without adequate safety measures, transparency, or accountability." With that quote, Dr. Murthy announced a push for warning labels on social media platforms to alert parents about potential mental health risks to adolescents. He compared its effects to public health risks like road fatalities and contaminated food. Now, despite research showing significant mental health risks for teens using social media excessively, the implementation of such labels requires congressional approval, with no current legislation introduced. Dr. Draskowski is one of our neurologists here. How might social media use impact developing brains of children?
Well, this is an absolutely fascinating and evolving area of discussion and study at this point in time. In the past, it has been noted that the neurologic consequences of using excess use of these devices and media has difficulty with internet gaming addiction, language development, processing of emotional signals. In fact, the World Health Organization in 2019 suggested a restriction in student use of cell phones based on reduced working memory, psychological problems, as it mentioned, depression and anxiety, and even sleep disorders. Interestingly, there's been some work done with high intensity use of touch screens, the thumb and the forefinger, that can actually reshape and reorganize the somatosensory cortex of the brain.
Wow.
So it's a really important topic. Diffuse tensor imaging and fMRIs in some studies has shown that higher use of screen-based media lowers executive functions, which is basically the ability to plan and to execute and get ready for tasks that must be done during the day. It also limited literacy abilities. Think about that. White matter tracts have some poor connection between, as the other members of the panel remember, Broca's and Wernicke's area in the brain for language. They've shown that the connections in these areas can be modified by high intensity use of these devices. So it really is something that needs to be continued to be looked into and followed. You know, so I kind of agree with Dr. Murthy on this, that we should probably consider doing a little bit more than we are at this point.
Dr. Knight, I know you manage chronic health conditions. Can social media be leveraged for good, or the risk just too high?
I do have quite a lot of patients who are on social media, and there is risk involved, certainly. And it's just when it comes down to, I should say, unverified health information, and there's so much information out there, and whether it's social media or some other, you know, blogs or journals that may not be well vetted or reviewed, then that information can be damaging. Now, in some of the good cases, though, I've had patients who have, they haven't had any awareness of medical conditions and such, and what symptoms that they might be suffering from. So they given guidance on possible diagnoses or things to talk to their doctor about. And I think in those cases, it could be good because it's just generated conversation as a conversation starter. And it's also good in place where there's non-pharmacologic or non-prescribed treatments that may be helpful. And there's so many of those that are out there. It's kind of just trial and error. It's, you know, for example, a patient with chronic pain, there's so many things you could do for chronic pain, whether it's meditation, acupuncture, topical medications and things like that. And not every physician may have a broad depth of knowledge to speak on every single one of those, but others who have tried those may be able to speak on that from their experience. So in those cases, it can be helpful.
Dr. Cowart, last question on this topic. I know you work in hospital admissions. Are you seeing any links between social media use and hospital admissions? I know that you're in adults, but any observations you can provide from your vantage point?
Yeah, I would say in adult medicine, I would probably look more at consequences of people consuming various types of media, including social media, that is leading them to further distrust of the healthcare system or into some of those more questionable healthcare practices, like what we were talking about earlier, vaccine hesitancy, vaccine denial, you know, things like that. Those are things that I worry about with my adult patients. But as a parent and having, you know, kids who are starting to look, you know, like nearing teenage years and trying to navigate these times where I tend to agree with Dr. Murthy that social media has its benefits for some, but it also has some serious risks, and it may have particularly serious risks on the developing, child brain. Having to navigate those conversations daily in my family with my kids about why I don't think they can navigate social media safely now, what might be a better age to start to introduce them, the risks of being on the computer all the time and screens and attention, as well as exposure to, at times, you know, behaviors that I don't want my kids constantly exposed to, eating disorders, for example, or body toxicity, or predators online. You know, there's a lot of things out there that make me nervous about young kids and teenagers being on social media. And we really haven't ever grappled with this as a society about what we do with kids. So I worry very much when the generations of young people who have really grown up with all this unfettered social media really start to, you know, kind of hit the hospitals and hit the healthcare system in larger ways, and how that impacts all of us. So But I also think in the adult setting, just wanting people to get access to the most appropriate information, go to social media and get support by all means, but be sure that you're getting your healthcare information also from trusted and reliable sources and not, you know, not just going with what somebody said on Facebook or Instagram, because like someone said earlier, there's a price tag on a lot of those things and people are selling you stuff and you want to be sure that you're getting balanced and objective information elsewhere.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, it's our monthly medical roundtable, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. Yet another topic, Dr. Draskowski, coffee and Parkinson's prevention. A study by the University of Turku found that consuming over 3 cups of coffee daily reduces dopamine levels in early stage Parkinson's patients, offering no symptom improvement. Now, while caffeine may lower initial Parkinson's risk, it doesn't benefit dopamine systems in diagnosed patients. I know that this was published in a fairly important journal from the neurology world, but I'll just get right to the question that most people will be wondering. Should we all be drinking coffee or limiting coffee? This is one of those studies I never know what to do with when it comes into how it relates to a common condition like Parkinson's.
Well, yeah. I mean, Joe, it's you know, I don't know that I would drink coffee just to, you know, to avoid Parkinson's disease, but I'm going to continue to drink coffee, as I'm sure you are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a wonderful drink to utilize. For those of you that, as a reminder, Parkinson's is a neurodegenerative disorder, and it has tremor, stiffness, and balance issues, and many other secondary features. The study showed no change in symptoms. So I guess the question is, does the use of coffee over a long period of time really protect us? There's a meta-analysis out there of 4 studies over 4 to 10 years that say, yeah, it may present disease progression. So if you have Parkinson's disease, I think, with the advice of your doctor, cardiologist, and hypertensive specialist, you know, feel free. I think I would go for it. It's a reasonable thing.
Fair enough. We're going to go to yet another topic, Dr. Knight. Everyone is flying right now. It's summer season and planes are packed. A recent study reveals that airplane cabins lower air pressure and oxygen levels. And if you combine it with alcohol consumption, it can exacerbate health risks like reduced oxygen saturation, which increases your heart strain during sleep. This highlights broader concerns about the impacts of extreme environments on human health, paralleling findings from a new research study on space flight's effects as well. They found that space missions pose challenges such as bone density loss, muscle atrophy, and increased cancer risks. Yet advancements in space medicine show no insurmountable barriers to long-term space habitation. Both studies remind us about tailored health measures when we are not on ground Earth. I guess my question to you, Dr. Knight, first of all, let's get to the practical thing. Alcohol on airplanes. Can you comment?
Yeah, from coffee to, I guess, a glass of wine now. It's quite different approaches. But and honestly, I don't know if there's many other better times to have a drink than when you're flying and dealing with all the stress of flight, right, and air travel and everything. And maybe the only other time is when you're flying with little children, like we do often with 4 young children. But, I guess what you have to recognize, you know, what goes up must come down, right? No pun intended, but you get this relaxing effect from the alcohol, but you still have to deal with collect your bags from the baggage claim, finding a taxi, getting to the hotel, whatever else you're doing. So there's a lot to juggle there. But this is very interesting research that's coming out. And it's, you know, you hear about medical events on planes, and you begin to wonder why, which is, I can only imagine this is where the researchers were kind of inspired to look into this more detail, is, you know, what's going on with these medical events on air travel and I think, you know, there's been some a lot of stories of people having, whether it's, you know, blood clots or cardiac events and things like that. So I think this does shed light into it, that alcohol combined with the, you know, decreased concentration of oxygen and, you know, all the effects of, you know, oxygen saturation and heart rate variability and things like that. So yeah, it's, I think it's a good reason to be careful. And certainly how much you're drinking, how long the flight you're on, and certainly if other medical history is pertaining to such risks that would be related to heart rate changes or low oxygen. So maybe having more of a thorough conversation with your doctor if you have such conditions as high blood pressure or cardiac disease, sleep apnea and such. So it's really interesting to see this research coming out.
One last question on this topic. Now, this one's specific to space, because we are seeing a lot of headlines on space travel, especially with space tourists and things of that sort. As I mentioned in that study about looking at the health challenges in people that spend time in space, do you believe there are not any insurmountable obstacles for people living out in space for a lifetime based on what we know so far?
Well, that's a very good question. And certainly when we're just talking about research, even just air travel alone, just, you know, a short flight could cause fluctuations in oxygen pressures and things like that, and risk for, you know, cardiac events. But so I don't know that it's, say, they're insurmountable. But I think we need more research in this direction to understand what are all of the cardiometabolic effects on the body, not only from air travel, but space travel. It's certainly growing. We had a great presentation recently on our medical grand rounds at the Mayo Clinic Florida campus from an astronaut who's actually chief medical officer for a private space company. And he was talking about just, you know, some of these medical issues, gravity being the big one, obvious one, but it can, I mean, our bodies are ecosystems, right? That every system is affecting another system. And so just some changes, just like gravity, can affect your heart rate. It can affect your, you know, your space balance, your maybe even your appetite, your clotting risk and things like that. So I wouldn't say it's insurmountable. I think the record is around 14 months now for the longest duration in space by a Russian cosmonaut. So it's quite a long time. But I guess in the future, we'll have to look at ways to make that even longer, because it's just growing interest, I know.
We're going to pivot to yet another topic, Dr. Cowart. This is one that I had to read two or three times to believe that this was true. And this has to do with the story of a four top singer and his experience at Ascension Macomb Oakland Hospital. Evidently, Alexander Morris, a member of the legendary Four Tops, is suing Ascension Macomb Oakland Hospital for racial discrimination and false imprisonment. When Morris visited the emergency room with chest pain, the staff assumed he was mentally ill and restrained him in a straitjacket after he mentioned his celebrity status. They didn't believe him. They thought he was crazy. Despite clear symptoms of cardiac distress, he was denied proper medical care. They are now filing a federal lawsuit that highlights systemic racism and the mistreatment of Black patients in healthcare, demanding accountability and reform. I know you're a hospitalist, Dr. Cowart. Your reaction to this story, what do you think? I had to read it so many times to believe it.
This story really, it's very painful to read. I'm very sorry that this happened to Mr. Morris. So, I think the specifics described in this story, I would hope, are not that common, but you know, there's a lot of things that happen that maybe don't get reported. So it would be my hope that, that this kind of overt, you know, activity would be uncommon, but, it may be more common than we fully would realize. And certainly low level systemic bias, systemic discrimination, unconscious bias, those are very common. We continue to see throughout our United States healthcare system differences and discrepancies in terms of how patients are treated in terms of referrals for cancer screening, for example. And we see lower rates of referrals for cancer screening in patients who are Black compared to patients who are not Black. So there's a lot of systemic differences in how patients are treated. Some of that comes down to individual decisions made moment to moment by staff members dealing with one patient in front of them, and some of them are more systemic issues. So for example, perhaps your staff believe that more patients of one ethnic group are likely to be uninsured compared to another group.
Sure.
Then that may influence how often they are referred for cancer screening. But that is, we see that impacts how patients are referred for screening, even in a system where everyone has the same insurance. So all of that to say, we have a long way to go in the US and in our healthcare system. And so I think continuing to be aware when someone is either overtly, you know, receives treatment that's not appropriate, like as what is alleged in this, this lawsuit, or low level, the microaggressions, you know, someone asking, where are you from, you know, five times, and trying to determine what someone's ethnic background is, or making assumptions about someone's education background based off their skin color, things like that. The person making these statements may not have ill intent, but the impact can be really harmful, and it can lead to and contribute to those long-standing disparities in healthcare that we see. So I don't know the specifics of this lawsuit, but I'm really sorry that if this is what happened and these allegations is very serious, and I'm glad that this person is seeking, you know, seeking justice through the federal system.
One last question, Dr. Cowart, as a hospitalist, if someone, their loved one or patient, is confused, what's the best advice for patients to be believed by hospital staff as opposed to be restrained? Any quick suggestion on that?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I just want to say is that there's a difference here between you know, being believed and being confused, and then being restrained. So we are required by federal law to use restraints sparingly in the hospital. Restraints are a tool that we have to use, but someone can be confused and not require restraints. We are required to use the least restrictive means to handle patients, even when they are confused. So someone may be confused, they might even be delusional, but if they are not a harm to themselves or others, then we would be advised to use tactics like redirection, frequent reorientation, have someone sit with the patient, have family members sit with the patient, remind them what's going on. All of those things are less likely to cause harm and are less restrictive than use of restraints. So, you know, people may be confused, but that by and of itself does not necessarily require restraints. And so, I know as the healthcare system has continued to work on recovering all of our staffing after the public health emergency, there may be issues where they're using restraints rather than, you know, using those more high touch, high staffing strategies, like having a sitter or having someone redirect the patient. But that would always be, in my opinion, preferred. And then we save our use of restraints for those patients who are actively at risk of harm to themselves or others because they are so confused that they're in an agitated delirium state.
Understood. And up next, our experts answer your questions. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist and professor of healthcare administration and policy. This is What's Health Got to Do with It. Our associate producer, Jamie Vallee, joins us now with questions for our experts from our listeners. Jamie, how are you?
I'm good.
What do you have in the mailbag for us?
So our first question is for Dr. Drazkowski. It's from Susan. She's from Denver, Colorado. And she writes, I swim with my friend every morning at the nearby Y. One morning, a casual acquaintance showed up and she told us she was glad because her doctors have told her she had an abnormal EEG and was advised to never swim alone. My friend and I are not trained to manage emergencies. Should we find another time to swim?
Dr. Draz, this sounds more like an ethics question, but I think it's a, let's respond to Susan from Denver.
Well, this is actually a very germane question. I live in the Sonoran Desert, and you know, I treat a lot of epilepsy patients, and one thing everybody has here in the desert is swimming pools. So this topic actually comes up quite a bit. So over the years, I've given that same advice about never swimming alone, especially for people who have a neurologic disease where they could lose consciousness or lose awareness. I've lost several patients over the years to drowning, and it's always a tragedy. It's never a fun thing. I continue to, whenever I give the conversation, I think back to those patients that I've lost over the years. One tragic case, drowned in 3 inches of water in a swimming in a bathtub, bathing his child. So it is very relevant. So even if you don't have epilepsy, swimming alone can be, it's good advice from the provider, I think. So whether you find somebody else to assist or take a different time, you know, usually this goes along with further advice for maybe getting a little training. Most of the public pools like the Y's and things have a plan to rescue people from the water. Sometimes they have lifeguards. But as a person, if you have friends with you, maybe take it as an opportunity to actively learn these techniques about near drowning rescue, and or even learning CPR. I think you should be able to come up with a plan to make it doable for yourself. Finding another time to swim. Yeah, I suppose so, but. Maybe you can work it out so you can do it when you want to do it, too, with your friends. So good luck with that and, you know, stay safe.
I love that. Good advice. What else do we have, Jamie?
So we have a question for Dr. Knight. David from Sacramento, California says, how is AI being used to improve the diagnosis and treatment of chronic diseases? And are there any recent breakthroughs?
Dr. Knight, I hear AI in my every morning, every night. It is such a huge thing when it comes to healthcare. How would you answer, David?
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's getting a lot of attention, a lot of hype right now. And, you know, the short answer is that it has afforded us a lot of, another way of accessing information for patients. So these large language models where you have, you know, ChatGPT, and then you can kind of get a more thorough explanation than you would just in a Google search. So it's good for that. Now, as far as big breakthroughs in diagnosis and treatment of chronic disease, not so much yet. I think the discussion that comes up with AI medicine is that, oh no, you know, AI is going to take over doctors and things like, we're not going to have any need for radiologists and things like that. The funny thing is actually that's been said for many years now, and it hasn't taken over anything yet. And I don't think it will, honestly, at least in the short term period, because there's so much to the role of the doctor counseling patients, understanding what their needs are, exactly prioritizing conditions and things that AI can't do. Now, it's certainly a tool that a provider can use to that end, and as well having access to information for them, cataloging information, reviewing medical records and things like that. So those are probably the biggest areas of development right now. We've been using trialing some AI programs for ambient listening. So picking up, recording the conversation between patient provider and documenting some of that. So it takes less time out of the chart for the provider and actually more time in discourse with the patient, which is really important and may divulge information that would otherwise be missed if the provider has just spent typing the whole time during the visit. So, you know, there are some gradual breakthroughs, which I think will come bigger and bigger as time goes by, but it's certainly a lot of hype around the discussion of it right now.
Jamie, what other person may we help today?
So Emily from Charlotte, North Carolina has a question for Dr. Cowart. What are some of the biggest challenges patients face when navigating hospital care, and how can they advocate for themselves effectively?
Dr. Cowart, Emily asks, I think, kind of a fundamental medical question. How would you answer it?
That is a really great question. I think if I had to summarize, the biggest challenge is that hospital care is enormously complex. Healthcare in general is enormously uncomplex, and it's just getting more and more so every day as we add new drugs and new tools and new diagnostics. If you're in the hospital, there's frequent handoffs. You're seeing different people every shift, new nurses, new doctors, new providers. It's just very, very complex. And if you're the patient in the hospital, you likely don't feel very good. You're not at your cognitive best because you're sick. And so it's very common for all the healthcare teams to do their very best to communicate. And yet people get home and they're not sure what happened. They don't remember. They know somebody said something about that medicine, but they don't remember what it is or why they're taking it or what they're supposed to watch out for. So in that setting of deep complexity, I would advise people to use any tools that they have in order to prepare. So if you have family who is able to come with you to any of your hospital appointments or is able to join on the phone or participate in a FaceTime visit while you're in the hospital, have them meet with your treatment team, meet with your nurses and your providers, listen into the conversation with everyone's full permission that these new people are there, participate in that care. Help take notes for you, help be sure that they're asking those questions that when you're in the hospital and you're the patient, you're so tired, you just want to go home. It's very common to get home and have a bunch of questions and wish you had asked them while you were there, but you were just in a hurry because you really wanted to get out of there. So use your family members if that's available to you. I know that isn't always possible for some people, but if you have family who's able to help, please use them. If you have friends or neighbors who are able to help, or folks from your church or your faith background who are able to help, having another person there can be enormously helpful. Now, some people may not have those other people to help. It is possible in some cases to ask your provider for permission and then record the conversation that they're having with you. But please always make sure that you ask for that permission. Many states have laws that do not allow for single party consent on audio recordings. And then in some cases that can really be perceived negatively by the healthcare team if they feel they're being recorded without their permission. But if a patient asks me to record a conversation because they need to hear it and listen to it later, I generally provide that consent. And then I know we're all being recorded and we're going to have a conversation that's going to live into posterity. And I try to make sure that I'm answering those questions in a way that will make sense for someone listening to it down the road who maybe wasn't there in that moment.
Great answer. We have time for just one more question. Jamie, what is that?
This question is for Dr. Draz. It's from Anonymous. My husband and I have been married for 10 years. It's been a bad marriage. We have no kids. And if I'm being honest, I am ready for a divorce and a new life. Yet recently it came up that my husband might have the early signs of dementia. I want out as I didn't bargain for this. Can I still divorce him and let his family manage this? Or must I stay and blame my bad marriage on Alzheimer's?
Dr. Draz, I don't know how to where to put this question. This is more ask the ethicist, but do your best on this one.
I'd only chuck a little bit. First of all, I'm so sorry to hear about this. This sounds like a very troubling and complex situation. I can only imagine what, you know, both of you are going through. Very sad. First of all, you still can't get a divorce if you have Alzheimer's disease, or at least that's what my brother, who's an attorney, says. You know, I've had conversations with him about people that have potentially impaired, cognition. It complicates the situation. You can still do it. So you have to maybe find the right attorney for that. You have to understand, I can certainly understand your frustration with the situation, but if you've made that decision, it shouldn't be a barrier to it. I think it complicates the issue a bit. But, you know, you can seek, if there's questions about the Alzheimer's disease, you know, you can seek help from the association, the Alzheimer's Association. And don't forget yourself in this whole process. It sounds incredibly stressful, and you sound, you know, I didn't talk to you, but it sure sounds like you would be under a considerable amount of stress. So seek help for yourself too, and get some advice from your provider, you know, your personal healthcare provider. Go to friends, family, counselors, or spiritual guidance. I think, you know, get some help if you're struggling that hard. I wish I could be more specific in it, not knowing the specific situation. It can be done, but, you know, it may complicate things a little bit. But take care, and I wish you the best for both of you.
I appreciate that, and we'll let that be our final word. I want to thank you, Dr. Draskowski, for your wonderful wisdom and your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Always a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Dr. Jennifer Cowart, thank you for your time and all your great answers today as well.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's always a pleasure to be on.
It's so good to have you here. And Dr. Dacre Knight, great wisdom and insights as well. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. And I learned a lot too, so really glad to be here.
As I did as well. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Corum is our director. Jamie Vallee is our associate producer. Next week's program is a look at the latest in ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and preventing veteran suicides. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.